Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's been exactly 1,000 days since the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. Exactly 1,000 days. And now, only China, along with just Macau and North Korea, continue to enforce a strict zero COVID policy of lockdowns, mandatory centralized quarantine, and testing to use basic services. Although that may be changing. However, just 2 months ago, Chinese President Xi Jinping doubled down on his signature zero COVID policy during his opening speech at the 20th National Congress of the Chinese Communist Party.
In responding to the sudden outbreak of COVID-19, we put the people and their lives above all else and tenaciously pursue a dynamic zero COVID policy. In launching an all-out people's war to stop the spread of the virus, we have protected the people's health and safety to the greatest extent possible and made tremendous encouraging achievements in both epidemic response and economic and social development.
However, more than 400 miles away in Zhengzhou, the opposite was happening. A COVID outbreak at the world's largest iPhone factory that led to its 200,000 workers being walled off from the outside world. Reports also suggest that food became the leading source of concern at the site. Cafeterias were shut down in an effort to minimize spread. And while workers on the production lines were given boxed meals, workers who were infected or afraid to leave their dorms were left with minimal options such as bread and instant noodles. After our arrival here, no one has taken care of us. We got two breads yesterday, says this Foxconn worker in a video shared on Chinese social media, specifically the platform of Weibo. The woman had tested positive for COVID, but had not been able to get a follow-up test. So she goes on saying, I contacted people in our quarantine WeChat. I called the so-called caring hotline for staff, but no answer either. I don't know what to do. I feel we've been abandoned to perish alone. Well, since then, there have been violent protests. Tens of thousands of workers have fled the plant. The big whites are hitting people, come, 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 the voice in the video yells. The big whites he's referring to are what the workers call COVID control officers in white hazmat suits. Well, the unrest could not be contained. In November, as Chinese soccer fans turned to the FIFA World Cup, they saw maskless spectators filling the crowds in Qatar, and a social media post went viral. In that post, it said, quote, audiences at the Qatar World Cup are not wearing masks or required to have PCR test results available with them. Aren't they on the same planet we live? Doesn't the COVID virus hurt them? The person wrote. Well, that post has been taken offline. Then on November 24th, an apartment fire in Urumqi, a majority Uyghur neighborhood in Xinjiang, killed 10 people and injured 9 more, according to the Chinese government's official report. It was a moment that many who've lived under the zero COVID policy feared. They could relate to it, as efforts to contain the spread of COVID in China include locking fire escapes and boarding up apartments. Now, Urumqi authorities say that did not happen in this specific building, but family members dispute the reports. Muhammad Ali lost his mother and siblings in the fire, and he spoke to CNN.
They could not escape because the fire escape was blocked, and the fire escape to the roof of the building was also locked.
What followed was the most remarkable series of public demonstrations China has seen in more than 30 years. Protesters took to the streets in many Chinese cities, chanting, no PCR tests, we want freedom. And in some places, the cries went beyond COVID policies and to the man who is enforcing them on the Chinese people. Xi Jinping, step down, the protesters are shouting. Well, the protests in China today are the most internationally visible demonstrations in China since Tiananmen Square. So could this mark the surfacing of deeper discontent in Chinese society, discontent that's been successfully suppressed for the last 33 years? That's what we're going to talk about today. And joining us is Yingying Cheng. She's a fellow and research scholar at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center and a frequent columnist on Chinese politics and U.S.-China relationships. Yingying, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me back.
I'd first of all like to start out with the acknowledgement that what we see in Western media is, by definition, a somewhat selective view of what's actually happening in a nation as vast as China. So can you tell us, are the representations of the Chinese protests that are in Western media, including the one I just presented here, are they accurate?
Thank you so much. And I should say here that I really, really appreciated how you opened the show by talking about how this massive nationwide protests did not just start in urban residences or on college campuses, but really started with labor movement with migrant workers at the Foxconn plant, the world's largest iPhone factory that's located in Zhengzhou in central China, as well as among migrant worker communities in Guangzhou. And then later, the immediate catalyst that triggered this nationwide protest is this fire in Urumqi that most directly impacted Uyghur communities and claimed Uyghur lives. And I think there is a lot of attention that is being paid to these protests in Western media, and sometimes there is these urban college-educated middle-class residents and college campuses are the ones that receive the most attention because they chant the slogans that are most legible to a foreign to a Western audience. However, we should understand that there are many layers to these, and these protests have spread to well over a dozen Chinese cities. A lot of them are very material demands with very concrete demands, and some of these are also elevated to a more political, ideological level, asking for a different form of governance.
Yes, and so that's exactly why I wanted to ask that question, right? Because there is this gravitational pull in the West to see any sign of discontent in China as wanting it to be discontent with the Chinese government, right? And especially since 1989. But let's peel back some of the layers that you're talking about of what's actually happening in China. First of all, in order to understand the nature of the protests, who's protesting and what their demands are, where are you looking in Chinese media, social media? How are you gathering your information, Yingying?
I think one thing that is very important is that China should not be exoticized. And so I myself, actually, during this most recent wave of protests, my most important source of information is actually Twitter. And this is quite interesting because there has been a lot of chatter about the future of Twitter with this new acquisition and new owner. However, it is really it provides a vital public function that is really irreplaceable by any other existing platforms. And what has happened during this wave of protest is that the Great Firewall of China that separates the internet within China domestically and internationally has acted not so much as a barrier but as a bridge, that there are a lot of these protests that are being videoed and filmed inside China. They are being shared on Chinese social media, but they are also simultaneously being sent to Twitter, to people outside of China who then post these on Twitter and Telegram and Instagram and a lot of these other platforms. So while these videos may be censored inside China, they are being preserved outside of China. And then some of these being preserved can be resent back inside the Great Firewall and have a second round of life. And so I've been quite glued to Twitter and also some other platforms over these past several days of unrest and following this these developments.
Okay. So that's interesting. I'm looking at your Twitter feed, actually, right now. And what it is public, Yang. But just yesterday, for example, you retweeted an anonymous poem that's been circulating widely on social media. It's a protest poem that's come out of China. And its first few lines are, "If you're not willing to walk at the front, please follow our march from behind. If you're not willing to follow, please watch from the side of the road. If you're not willing to watch, please shout online. If you're not willing to shout out online, please close your eyes in silence. Sit back and enjoy the rights we have fought for you, but don't turn a blind eye and don't sneer, because the sunlight we have struggled for belongs both to me and you." Why did you retweet that? I mean, tell us the significance of that kind of language coming out of China now.
Yeah, and this is a poem, I believe it came out from the students at Nanjing Communications College, mm-hmm. Which is a city in eastern China that's like an hour away from where I grew up. And I think it is really, really a powerful message that is also, it is not particularly grand, but it's about individuals' responsibilities in this moment of social and political upheaval, but also in general, right? Like individuals would evaluate what they can do, what they feel comfortable about, especially in an authoritarian society. Each individual evaluate their own risks. However, it is so important that people, even if they are not the ones standing on the front lines, still keep their sense of right and wrong and not be an active, everyone, like there is a degree of collective guilt or complicity, but not be the ones that are actively assisting the oppressive machineries of the state, but really be able to see where the power dynamics lie and how everyone is connected in this broader movement of things.
Well, today we are trying to understand the many layers of protest and their meaning and their goals that have been going on in China. And Yang Chong is our guide to that. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're trying to understand in detail the many layers of protests that have been going on in China. And I'm joined by Yang Chong. She's a fellow and research scholar at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center, a frequent columnist on Chinese politics and U.S.-China relations, and one of my favorite guests on China, Yang, if I can say that. So let me ask you, I'd love to hear from you in as much detail as you'd like to provide, what the sort of lived realities of people in China have been like under the government's zero COVID policy. Because again, I'm just trying to break through the sort of the selective representations that we see in Western media and get a deeper understanding of what's actually happening there. What has it been like for people?
This is a really great question. And if I may, since you mentioned at the very beginning of the show that this is exactly 1,000 days since the WHO announced the pandemic, and it's exactly 3 years since the first cases were reported in Wuhan. And so if we actually, I think to understand the current dynamic, it's helpful to zoom out a little bit, and I'll take a very quick walk through this, that at the very beginning, right, it was the Chinese government, the local officials, starting with the local officials, but then also to higher levels of government, were trying to cover up the initial outbreak and were being ineffective in stemming the initial outbreak in the first few weeks. And then, so that action caused a lot of public anger and discontent, especially after like one of the whistleblower doctors, Dr. Li Wenliang, died of COVID later at the very beginning of 2020. And so we saw massive protests online on social media among the Chinese citizens. And then the government quickly implemented lockdown policies across the country, and within several weeks to a few months, very effectively contained the outbreak. And through that process, the Chinese government was able to rewrite a narrative into one of triumph. And through much of 2020 and basically entire year of 2021, that narrative has been successful, that the Chinese people, by and large, were having this renewed sense of confidence or even a sense of pride that their government was being so effective in containing the pandemic, while a lot of other countries, especially Western countries like US and countries in Europe, were having these massive outbreaks and very high death tolls. However, because this is a pandemic and this virus mutates and changes. So a lot of this dynamic has shifted at the end of 2021 with the emergence of the Omicron variants and the other types of pandemic dynamics that is so much more transmittable on one hand. On the other hand, doesn't seem to cause such severe illnesses on the immediate term, though the longer term effects are still to be determined. And so with these new variants, some other countries such as like Taiwan or New Zealand that have implemented a rather strict zero COVID policy in the beginning of the pandemic have shifted their approach from prevention to mitigation. However, this is when the Chinese government doubled down on its zero COVID policy to really trying to stanch this Omicron outbreak. And this is where through 2022, this year, that we see these very, very stringent lockdown policies are being implemented and how these close contacts are being interpreted in such a way that even if you're living in a building, a different floor or even a different unit has one suspected case and the entire building may go under lockdown. And in a lot of these very strict lockdown cases, people are really barred from leaving their apartment buildings. So there is a very serious concern with regards to access to food, to basic necessities, and to basic medical care. We see reports about people having medical emergencies, asthma attacks, heart attacks, people in labor who are being denied medical care, life-saving medical care, because they didn't have a negative PCR COVID test within the past 24 hours or so. And so this has been a lived reality for a lot of people in China throughout this year if their cities have or their districts and communities have undergone very strict lockdowns. And for people who have not experienced the direct effect of the most stringent lockdowns, they still live under this constant fear that this lockdown might take place. And so this is a very, very different situation compared with what some may have experienced here in the U.S. in 2020 with regards to the mask mandates or the stay-at-home advisories. And so what the zero COVID lockdown in China and the ensuing protests, one way I want to help maybe the audience understand is that this really can be interpreted as a form of prison break.
Prison break. Just the other day, Yang, I saw on Twitter, on social media, video, for example, of what looked to be a Chinese family being dragged out of their apartment by men in hazmat suits to be taken to some sort of centralized quarantine. Again, I just constantly want to be cognizant of selective representations, but that's the kind of thing that you're talking about?
So these things have indeed happened, and I think what has also, like, people are being forced into centralized quarantine, and while they are being placed in quarantine, their homes are being broken into and basically sprayed with disinfectants with a lot of damages to the property. And these have happened at a very significant scale in a lot of cities. A lot of attention have been paid to the Shanghai lockdown in April, in the spring. However, like Shanghai is the biggest, richest city in China. In a lot of the smaller cities where there is not so much Western media attention, some of these have been under strict lockdowns for a very long time, several months, with a very, very severe social human cost.
Mm. And so this, to ask an obvious question, but I want to lay this out here, this is happening everywhere in China.
So the lockdown by itself has not affected every single city. For example, the hometown where I grew up in, the city itself has not gone under blanket lockdown. Some districts have. And however, as I mentioned earlier, because this is a zero COVID policy is so strictly tied with the Chinese top leadership. And so on the local implementation level, it's being used as a way to show political loyalty. It has really carried on. It's not just as a public health mission, but as an ideological mission. And so for any cities or districts or municipalities that have seen an outbreak, a cluster of COVID cases, usually the response is very severe. But some places may have been spared just because they didn't have a significant outbreak. But this is a constant fear for anyone who's living in China or for anyone who has loved ones in China.
Uh-huh. Okay. The reason why I asked that is because, again, as a journalist in the West, my historical touch point is 1989, right? Mm-hmm. And Tiananmen. But I wonder, in Tiananmen Square, there was an uprising, a pro-democracy uprising against the Chinese government, and then obviously a brutal crackdown. Is it fair to say, though, that that was relatively localized? Whereas what the Chinese people are experiencing now is the overt expression of the Chinese government's power across the country in a way that perhaps, you know, a massive number of people in China have never experienced before.
Thanks so much for this question. And since you mentioned Tiananmen, I would first of all say that Tiananmen Square by itself is in Beijing, in the nation's capital. But the pro-democracy movements and the social movements then at the end of the 1980s, before I was born, was really a nationwide movement. And so it was not only focused on in one city. And it was not just a student protest. It was also a labor movement that a lot of workers have organized and were demanding a different vision, a socialist democracy for China. So there is a complex dynamic with regards to Tiananmen as well. And also what is very important to think about is since 1989, protests have been happening in China rather frequently. Usually it's in the form of localized grievances, like land disputes in the rural regions, migrant workers' wage disputes, pension disputes, or some environmental issues. In the 2000s, even by some of the government's own figures, the number of protests can be as high as hundreds a day. And the absolute number of these protests have indeed decreased during Xi Jinping's reign over the past decade. But it is still a very, very common thing. However, as I mentioned, these types of protests are usually very localized and are participated by a specific group of people over a very specific grievance. And what this demonstrations over this past week with regards to the zero COVID lockdowns and the broader discontent has been remarkable because it is first of all nationwide, that spread to well over a dozen cities. Secondly, the participants are very diverse. There are students, there are migrant workers, there are urban residents, and across really a diverse array of social class and professions. And thirdly, it is triggered by the zero COVID lockdown policies, but the demands have escalated to more broader forms of questioning of governance. And of course, these first and foremost are because zero COVID policies is being implemented nationwide. That is being that is affecting basically everybody, and it is being tied with the top leadership of the Chinese government, of the Chinese Communist Party. And so zero COVID has really become emblematic of dictatorial control and the state's blanket power over everyday life in China right now.
Yeah. So that's why I wanted to make that distinction, because it does feel that this is different from protest movements in China before, or is it?
I do think that this moment is... It is a new chapter or different episode, and there are analogies or similarities that can be drawn with different types of social movements and protests in China before, including, I didn't mention, but like feminist and queer activism in China that has been a sustained social movement over the past several years that to some extent in the very beginning had escaped the government's radar because the government is patriarchal and didn't understand that feminists and queer people would have so much power. And these kinds of protests have been sustained and have spread overseas Chinese communities and seen transnational solidarity. And we see elements of that in this wave of protests as well. So this is not something that just sprung out of thin air. There are connections with a lot of previous localized or national or transnational movements. However, with the confluence of factors, there is also indeed a distinct uniqueness to the current wave of protests.
Yang, if I may ask, you were born a year or two after the Tiananmen Square protests and crackdown?
I was born several months after the crackdown.
Several months, okay. So let me ask you, in your childhood and teenage years growing up in China, how much was the presence of China's authoritarian rule, made aware in your day-to-day life?
So this is a very personal question. So I would speak it from my individual experience that I grew up in a medium-sized city in central eastern China in a very typical Chinese family. I was raised by a single mother who's a school teacher. And I remember actually very distinctly my first awareness of I live in a society that is probably not free, was when I was about 8 years old, when this was the first top leadership transition in China. And I wrote about it in my diary. Was just like I heard the names of these leaders on TV and I didn't know anything about them or their policies, but I was just curious. And so I wrote down their names in my diary. And my mom read them and then crossed out all of those lines. And I was like, as a young child, I was first of all a bit upset because I felt my mom invaded my privacy by reading my diary. But I actually got a very, very stern talking to that, oh, you cannot talk about or write about politics or national affairs and leave a written record of this. So I learned at a very, very young age that politics and death are the two biggest taboos. And so that is my first awareness of, oh, this is an authoritarian state. And then later on, later on in middle school and high school, when I learned more and had more language to express this. But my first idea about a speech not being free really came from that moment.
Wow. I'm just pausing, Yang, because I'm putting I'm just thinking back to, my childhood and teenagehood, and I wrote all sorts of stuff in my journals and never once told that it was a dangerous act or a risky act to, put down one's unfettered thoughts on paper. So that there is a powerful demonstration of the difference. Now, the reason why I had asked you about what you had personally experienced is, there's a question, this generational question in China. And in a recent episode of Consider This, the podcast from NPR, you were on Consider This along with Professor Mary Gallagher, who's the director of the Center for Chinese Studies at the University of Michigan. And Professor Gallagher said something that I want you to reflect on. And here's what she said.
These are students and workers who did not experience the 1980s, they did not experience a China that was closed. They experienced only successful, integrated, global China. And up until the reign of Xi Jinping, when he took over in 2012, 2013, there were really very few political constraints on them, in the sense that as long as they didn't oppose the government, they had wide spread kind of social and economic freedom, as well as cultural freedom in terms of how they consumed social media. And it's only the recent years that we've seen this really diminish and close down.
Yangyang, respond to that. I mean, was Professor Gallagher onto something?
Yeah, this is a really, really salient point. And tying to my earlier comment about my childhood experience, I think for a parent to tell a child certain things are taboo, this is both a sign of the authoritarian nature of the Chinese state, but also this is a sign of lingering trauma that for people of my parents' generation who came of age during the Cultural Revolution, who really experienced a form of state terror that was not experienced by my generation or the younger generation. And so that is a very, very important point. And so the younger generation, the millennial age on, really grew up with a sense of political freedom and economic prospects. However, over the past several years, both in terms of political freedom and economic prospects have been rapidly shrinking. And that is a major source of discontent among the younger generation in China.
Well, Yangyang Chang, stand by for just a moment because there's a lot more to talk about regarding the long-term implications of what's happening in China now, and we'll do that when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're joined by Yangyang Chung. She's a fellow and research scholar at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center and a frequent columnist on Chinese politics and U.S.-China relations. And Yangyang is helping us peel back the various and complex layers of the remarkable protests that we have been seeing in China over the past several weeks, and trying to really understand what's at the core of those protests and what the long-term implications are. Now, I had said earlier in the show that it seems to us here in the West that these are the most visible series of public demonstrations, internationally visible, in China since 1989 and the pro-democracy movement that culminated in Tiananmen Square. So we reached out to Zhou Fengshuo, and he is the president of the human rights charity Humanitarian China. Back in 1989, he was one of the 21 student leaders of the Tiananmen protests whose arrest was ordered by the Beijing Public Security Bureau. And Zhou says that watching the videos of the recent protests in Shanghai, he saw
hundreds of people were chanting, Xi Jinping step down, CCP step down, definitely reminded me of what we wanted 33 years ago. And the energy, passion for free China, that's all so familiar.
Now, quietly and very recently, the Chinese government has been making some changes. Just yesterday, commuters in Beijing and several other cities were allowed to board public transportation without a COVID test in the previous 48 hours. This change is coming for the first time in months. Now, does it mean that Xi Jinping is subtly dumping the COVID zero strategy? Well, Joe thinks yes.
I think the process have been a success for that reason. Xi Jinping, for the first time in his reign since 10 years ago, he made the concessions. He acknowledged defeat.
Well, the final outcomes, if any, and the implications long-term of the protest do remain to be seen. But Joe says that he hopes these events will serve as a moment of change.
I think going forward, the most important change still the protesters themselves, who were mostly fearful, self-censoring, like other people, but now all of a sudden, they have found their own strengths. Encourage, especially these young people outside of China. That's what's significant for the future. That will be the most important outcome of the protests, transformation of these young people.
That's Joe Fengshuo. He's the president of the human rights charity Humanitarian China. And in 1989, he was one of the 21 student leaders of the Tiananmen Square pro-democracy protests. Yongyang, I wonder if you agree with Joe that he thinks the protests are very successful because, in his mind, Xi has made concessions for the first time in years.
So I think this is we should indeed give a lot of credit to the incredibly brave Chinese people of different generations and ages and professions who put their bodies in the street and made their presence heard and made their demands heard. And so I think if we look at briefly the timeline, right, the most visible protest has started on Saturday on November 26th. And the next day on Sunday, November 27th, the People's Daily, the Communist Party's official newspaper still ran this front page that says we should stick to zero COVID without wavering. However, on Monday, after another day of protests that spread even further, the People's Daily ran again a front page that's about front page editorial that is about COVID control. But this time it did not use the word zero COVID or dynamic zero, but talked about scientific methods and precision. And then just yesterday, Xinhua, the state newswire, issued this report that says the most dangerous time with regards to the pandemic is already past and Omicron is milder and less dangerous. And so this dramatic reversal with regards to the state's messaging is indeed directly timed in response to the protests. So the protests have the timing is a direct result of the protest. We should see the protests as a very important reason, but not the only reason, that there are also a confluence of other factors, that this dynamic zero COVID lockdown policies is by construct ineffective as a public health measure and economically and socially unsustainable. And so there has been a lot of discontent in local governments as well. And so these protests have become this catalyst and that pushed the central government to shift its messaging and pushed a lot of local governments to change its policies.
Well, so this is very interesting because earlier in the show you had reminded us appropriately that the Chinese government, and I'm actually going to specifically say President Xi Jinping's choices and policies since 2019-2020 have shifted over time, right? So even though President Xi personally endorsed zero COVID policy and did so in, you know, just in October once again, should we perhaps not be so surprised that there have been a seeming beginning of a relaxation to that COVID zero policy now?
So I think there are layers to this. Like an authoritarian government still needs to govern. And so there are The Chinese government, including under Xi Jinping, still has a long track record with regards to responding or making concessions to very specific concrete material demands, both as a governing necessity and also as a response to public pressure. And on the other hand, there are also another layer of very important factors. There are certain things that the government does not concede on. So what we are seeing with regards to response to these most recent round of protests centered on the COVID lockdown policies is that the government made material concessions with regards to relaxing some of the COVID rules. That is a direct response to the protests, but also with the confluence of other economic and social factors. Mm. On the other hand, the government is also clamping down very hard on dissent, arresting protesters and checking people's phones randomly on the street and on public transportation. And so it is not relaxing with regards to its political power and ideological control in that respect.
That is so important, okay? Because I had wanted to ask you, Yang, that, you know, you're of course, yes, an authoritarian government still needs to govern, but we have seen in the past, and again, I keep going back to Tiananmen, because it's just still the most visible global example to the world in my recent memory, that there's a limit that the Chinese government has shown that it can tolerate, and then when movements past that limit, there's brutal crackdown, which we saw in 1989. So I was going to ask you, is it significant, or what significance should we glean from the fact that, you know, we're not seeing exactly the same kind of suppression this time, but it sounds like you're saying we're just seeing a modern version of it with the use of China's tremendous surveillance state, for example.
Mm. I think here the example of Tiananmen becomes salient in various ways. As you mentioned, right, the government cracked down very hard on the protests as the world saw. On the other hand, a government made material concessions with regards to economic opportunities and different types of economic and social freedoms through the 90s. And that partly was part of the demand in the complex movement that was Tiananmen as well. And so Tiananmen's legacy is also complicated, and it's not just tanks versus students.
Yeah.
And what we are, and I think here another thing, I get a bit wary about Tiananmen being overused as an analogy, partly as also because it is a story, it's a plot with a foregone conclusion, because we knew how that story ended. However, that is not the case with current movements or future movements, that its outcomes are contingent on a confluence of factors. Another example I might make is with regards to the pro-democracy protests that happened in Hong Kong. And there was also a lot of analogies are being made with Tiananmen. And then the analogy being made, the immediate next question is just about how oppressive or how brutal, bloody the suppression might be. But we didn't see that kind of oppression with regards to tanks and bullets in Hong Kong either. But the government used other measures, including this draconian national security law, that very effectively quenched the visible dissent and public demonstrations in Hong Kong. And so I think there is a need for a more capacious understanding and more vocabulary to understand different social movements in China, and not have that be confined by a single example that has somewhat been flattened and tokenized in the Western imagination.
Yeah, and I really take your point and appreciate it very deeply, Yang, which is why I'm trying to understand, you know, there can be in China, outside of China, you know, anywhere in the world, there can be protest movements that are protesting a government's policy, for example. Or there can be protest movements that are really protests against that government itself. Obviously, there's a lot of overlap. I mean, in China, can we even make that distinction? Should we be making that distinction?
I think, okay. I'll answer it in this way, that first of all, Chinese people are real people. So they are not just political symbols. And so they are real people living real lives with real concrete material demands. And so it is when we talk about we, I'm assuming we're talking about most of the audience of this show, the U.S. public. And so it is important to not tokenize the Chinese people or see their lives just as constant as a political symbol or as a spectacle. On the other hand, it is also very important to understand that different layers of political demands are connected with forms of with forms of governance, and people. I really appreciated what Zhou Fengsuo said, right? What is important in understanding this moment maybe is not so much what is the impact on the central government or Xi Jinping or the policy changes. Another part that I think is more important is this is a change that is happening in the people. That is a moment of political awakening for the younger generation in China and for a lot of the people who are participating in their first political demonstration or witnessing this moment. How that shifts their mindset with regards to recognizing their agency and their power, and they're also learning practical skills through the participation. And these can evolve down the road, and these are some of the things that we should be paying attention to as well.
Do you think that that is now an unstoppable force? And we don't know what direction it's going to go in. I completely agree with you. This story is not done and is not yet told. But I'm just trying to avoid using a cliche, but I can't. Is that a genie that can't be put back in the bottle? Do you know what I mean? In terms of the, you said this political awakening, especially amongst China's young people.
I think it depends, right? And also, I think here, if we go back to the TM analogy, like this is as a nationwide movement for people who experience that social movement, how they live their lives in the next few decades, it also differs a lot. There are people who continued with activism. There are people who chose different venues to seek ways to help their communities or seek means of political liberalization. So it is not a singular direction or singular form in terms of social engagement and in terms of political activism. What I do think it is important is, let me make this example. This nascent movement has been called the blank page movement because the most symbolic element with the protest is a lot of people were raising this blank sheet of paper as this sign of protest, but also as a way to show state terror and state oppression that things are being censored and cannot be said. And of course, that symbol was previously used in Hong Kong in 2020 after national security law, and also used earlier this year in Russia in protest against the invasion of Ukraine. So this is a global symbol. And this blank sheet of paper, by itself, it is like a mirror raised against the state, but it is also like an open door to a confluence of possibilities. And then just a few days ago on Twitter, I saw this video of like this group of local residents in the northern Chinese city who are protesting against this local utilities company that was not providing sufficient heating. And these people are holding these sheets of paper with only one Chinese character written on it, Leng, cold. And I found that to be absolutely remarkable, that there is no grand ideological demand in this. This is a very, very concrete material demand. However, because of this broader movement, the people also have this new technique, this new language. And so I think these are these little details, little bursts of defiance and civic activism that really are very fascinating and also have a lot of potential.
Well, we only have a few seconds, Yang, and I'm so sorry because I could talk with you for hours, but I just wanted to briefly go back to where we started and your truth that you're speaking about not flattening the Chinese people into stereotypes, because you said it was remarkable and important to note that this started, this being this current period of change in China started with labor. And I'm wondering what you think about the fact that those issues, those material challenges of workers in China in places like the Foxconn plant, those don't seem to be that they're going to change anytime soon.
I think here this is really important to note that since this is primarily a US-based audience, to recognize that the dramatic radical action of the Foxconn workers exposed that this is not just an issue about the authoritarian nature of the Chinese state. There is the complicity of global capital with regards to supply chains, with regards to labor exploitation. And these are the things that people in the US can resonate with as well and have means to take action and be in solidarity with workers in China and workers everywhere.
Well, Yangyang Chang, fellow and research scholar at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center, thank you so much, Yangyang.
Thank you so much for this conversation.
This is On Point.